Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update here at JM in the AM. Welcome back from Israel, and thanks for joining us this morning.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
You had an opportunity to meet Gilad Shalit this week?
We hosted him yesterday. It was very emotional for many people because of all the effort and time and resources that were put into securing and seeking his release. As I said to him, you know, we have to thank him, as he was expressing his gratitude. He said that he had known of some of the activities because he could hear the Arab radio, I guess his captors were listening to.
Wow.
And every once in a while they would broadcast about some of the activities. But he said he never realized the extent and the intensity of the efforts that were undertaken.
Does that include from his own family that he wasn't aware of the sacrifice they made?
He was not fully aware, no.
That's unbelievable.
We asked him about that, but remember, he had no contact.
Right. All right, so the big curiosities, of course, I mean, is he able to continue with a normal existence? Does he present to a group like yours? And it doesn't seem like he was in solitary for years, if you know what I mean?
He's very shy. I think it's his nature. He does not talk much. He was very appreciative of everything, and this was the first time he actually even answered some questions from people. And you know, the first question, of course, was, "Have you gained weight since you were out?" Because he's still very thin. But he's actually very—he's a charming young man. He's here attending some NBA games, and he wants to be a sports writer. But when he was asked questions like, how do you, you know, yesterday was the anniversary, the sixth anniversary of his capture.
Wow.
And he said that he was so busy, he didn't know it. And I said, I pray that you'll be so busy and with happy things in the future, you'll never remember the anniversary. But he, you know, he talked a little bit about it. And afterwards, of course, everybody assaulted him. I asked him if it was worse under Hamas than having to deal with the Jewish organization.
Very good.
He said it was better with the organization.
So, thank God. So everybody wanted the photo op. Everybody wanted to get together with it. I guess we can call him a Jewish hero, right? He'd go into that category.
The guy, he was captured serving the Jewish state,
right,
and the Jewish people.
Exactly.
He didn't collapse in those 5 years. He didn't turn against the state. He didn't do things that sometimes happen. So I think one can say that, you know, every soldier in Israel is a hero of the Jewish people.
No
every
question
one of them
about
puts their lives on the line in one way or another during the course of their service. And we should be appreciating
it. Yeah, I'm the first to always call them Jewish heroes, but in this case, I was looking to see if we would call this a heroic episode. The answer, of course, is yes. Was he accompanied by any family members?
No, he was accompanied by a man who has been helping him. He's done some documentaries. He used to work with Rabin, an Israeli veteran who took this on and gave him the opportunity to go to the Miami Heat games, I guess the finals or something, the NBA games. So I told him I hope that over time his choice of teams to support will get better.
Well, what do you mean? Did you have a chance to congratulate Ted Arison?
Not yet. Believe me, if I was following it, then I would have known.
Well, his team won the championship.
Yes, I know.
And his sister, if I'm not mistaken, is the richest woman in Israel.
Shari Arison.
Yeah.
Right.
She's living there for like 10 years or something already, if I'm not mistaken.
At least.
I think you should send a telegram. You still do that? You still do the telegram route or not? I think you should
send a telegram.
I think you should send a telegram to the Arison family today.
I'm too high tech.
No, I'm telling you. All right, send an email. I think you should acknowledge that standing up there with the greatest basketball player in the world right now was in fact the Jewish owner from a prominent supporting a family of Israel.
I will certainly take it under advisement.
Thank you. I want him to take one of my recommendations at least. All right, I hate to start local, but you know we will eventually get to international. Not only did Charles Barron lose, and I think it was obvious what, you know, that we were begging people to get out there and vote in the Brooklyn district in which he wanted to serve in the United States House of Representatives, and of course Hakeem Jeffries won, and from what I hear, at his victory celebration paid special attention to the Jewish community, which of course was very nice. But in one of the neighborhoods where Barron was supposed to sweep, you know, where he had immense support, he only got 52% of the vote, which I think is amazing.
It is quite remarkable. The result shows that we should never give up. That the I will tell you that the pundits and many people thought that, told me that Barron would win, that because he had such a large part of the district, certainly his name recognition, and people felt that, you know, he had a very intense campaign. The fact is that, and I think one of the turning points was David Duke's endorsement of him, that many people, even in the black community, other communities, looked at this and said, if this guy's getting an endorsement of David Duke, there's something wrong with this picture.
Good point.
And, I mean, he's a very dangerous guy, I think, and his election to the Congress would have sent a terrible signal all over the country. I think many people came to the conclusion, and the same conclusion, that even, I think, in his own district, where his Council Manic district, that he lost.
I was citing a neighborhood where they where the polls said he would win overwhelmingly. He only got half the vote.
And I think there are people who got behind this and who really played a key role. Jan Goldenberg, many others who took the lead, Hatzko Bennett, to try and expose this and motivate that community. I mean, it was not people outside the district could care and maybe contribute, but the fact is that it was what was important was what the turnout in the district. And there are many unions and others who really mobilized, and you know, while there was a split, I think DC 37 went with him, went with Barron, but 1199 and many of the others supported Hakeem Jeffries. So we can, this is a very important outcome.
And you've stressed to us that this is such an important year in terms of the House of Representatives and the Senate. So every one of these races has to be watched carefully, and the aftermath of each race has to be watched carefully.
And most of all, everybody go out and register. Your kids should register. Your parents should register. Brothers and sisters who are of age, anybody of age, should be registered. And do it now so that you can vote in November.
Yeah, no question about it. All right. I assume that you've seen the big deal the New York Times has made about this, and now, of course, it becomes an international... it gets international attention. Is it wrong to crown a Miss Holocaust survivor in Israel?
I was not aware of it.
Oh, so the Times today talks about this pageant.
I'm talking to you, so I don't get to that, but...
What do you mean?
I said I haven't had a chance to get to the Times.
Oh, because you're talking to me.
Right.
No, but the Times today has an article about a pageant that took place in Israel called Miss Holocaust Survivor, and of course some people... helped this create a big uproar, while others were saying that, you know, there's no big deal about it. So is this, again, an episode where even in Israel, some people go overboard and trivialize the Holocaust?
I can't understand the motivation behind it. Why anybody would even do a thing like that. And I do, to a degree, yes. It does trivialize the Holocaust by making it into a beauty pageant or associating it with it. I don't know the details, so I don't want to comment too much, but it just doesn't make any sense to me.
And I think that somebody, was it Colette Avital, who was quoted in that article, who said the exact same thing. She said that she just didn't understand the premise of the entire thing and why they would go about doing it. All right, folks, if you want to read more, you know where it is. Malcolm, last week, Vladimir Putin met with, this past week, I should say just a couple of days ago, with Benjamin Netanyahu. So last Friday, we spoke about the potential of what could occur during the meeting. What did occur during the meeting?
Well, it has not been publicly released, and actually it's been quite good in terms of maintaining the secrecy of the meeting. I was at the dinner with Putin, the state dinner, and had a chance to talk to the foreign minister and to some others briefly. The word is that it was an intense exchange, but the overall assessment was that they came to some basis for optimistic assessments of the exchange, but no concrete details. Obviously, Iran and Syria were the two major issues.
Mm-hmm.
Russia said, Putin said that he is not bound to Assad and not obligated to him, but I'm sure explained his own needs. And one of his concerns, and especially vis-a-vis Iran, where Israel asked them to be more passive and to honor the Security Council resolutions and support against the sanctions and to keep a united front with the West and not give the mixed signals to Iran, that Putin has to be concerned because of the implications for Chechnya, that when you start getting these kind of changes, number one, I think they're all concerned, and you hear growing concern about the possibility of a Muslim Brotherhood takeover in Syria as well. So for Russia, it has a whole series of agendas, including, I'm told, that they view the activities of Turkey with some suspicion. You know, Turkey was always a threat to Russia, and there have always been tensions between them. And the ouster of secular regimes and the rise of Islamists for Russia, which has a very large percentage of its officer corps being Muslims, and with Chechnya, where they killed tens of thousands of people without any, you know, public retribution or concern expressed, for them, this has a lot of potential ramifications.
Potential. Yeah,
very good.
Yeah, thank you. Syria went ahead and is building up its armies on the Turkish border. Are they getting set to fight a proxy war for Russia?
No, I think that this situation, which could be very serious, I don't think Turkey and Syria want to go to war. The fact that Turkey downed Syria downed a Turkish plane, and yet so far there's still been no retribution. There was a NATO statement. Supposedly this jet was back over international space. It had wandered into Syrian skies without warning, but it was shot down. There was no attempt made to contact the pilot, to talk to Turkish officials before it happened. And supposedly they may have fired even on another plane that came to search for it. And while there have been, you know, some pretty mild condemnations, the the fact is that Syria did it, and it shows, number one, as an assessment that that was shared with me, that Syria's air defense systems are probably, after Russia, the United States, and Israel, amongst the best in the world, and that it may have been a warning. It could have triggered immense reaction. Now, on the ground, we know that Turkey has moved tanks near the border. Remember, they have a big infiltration of people. There was talk of creating a safe corridor along the Turkish border by Turkey for people to escape, and people continue to cross. I know in one day there was a group of 6 officers and 33 soldiers, together with their families, almost 300 people, who crossed in one group. Obviously, Syria is concerned about the defections, but the massing of and Turkey claims that Syria has 5 times violated its borders, but they didn't consider it a hostile act and therefore didn't react, as opposed to what Syria did. So the downing of this plane raises many questions. One, why Turkey didn't immediately respond. It's clear that nobody wants an escalation of this conflict right now, and the question is, what will the longer term ramifications of it will be?
America's one and only Jewish Moments in the morning radio program, heard on listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope. Round the world on the web, jmam.org. Malcolm Honlein is back in the United States, speaking to us in regard to the events of the week. We call it the Weekly Update podcast, available if you go to jmam.org. In the news section of our website, you will see instructions on downloading the podcast or installing the podcast. And coming up from Israel, Rabbi Yudin will speak to us this week live from the Holy Land. That will be coming up. All right, the story of the week, and I apologize if I took too much time getting to it, is, of course, the new leadership in Egypt. By the way, when a member of the Muslim Brotherhood wins the presidency of Egypt officially, does the Prime Minister of Israel call to congratulate? Like, how does Israel react when that happens?
They call collect, but I think that Israel issued a statement saying that they respect the election outcome. I can tell you that there are people in Egypt and elsewhere who had indicated that they thought Shafik was in fact the winner, even up to 24 hours or less than 24 hours before the announcement. There had been a lot of pressure for them to announce the Muslim Brotherhood victor, if in fact he won the election numerically or not. I guess history books will have to say, but obviously his election, Morsi's election, I believe could be just the start of a huge transition that will the model I would look to is Erdogan of Turkey, where when the Islamists got in and the whole West said, oh, this is going to be a model, this is amazing, you know, we're going to see an Islamist, but it'll be pro-Western and all that. And what did he do? He moved to strip the military the power with the backing of the West, which is exactly, again, what we're hearing in vis-a-vis Egypt. And the Turkey's army was the protector of the Ataturk tradition, the secular tradition, just as the military in Egypt is. And you're going to see steps. I think he will be sworn in on Saturday, the president. He's going to establish a cabinet. He's going to then start asserting power. I think they will try to resurrect the parliament, which was disbanded by the military. And the question is, will they be able to deliver anything on the ground? These are well-disciplined. They have a base. But if you look at the real results, half the people voted, and of that, the Muslim Brotherhood guy got half, which means 25%, as opposed to 72% in the parliamentary election, which means people may be looking at this in Egypt itself and saying, this is not what we wanted. And the truth is that the media concentrated on Tahrir Square, so you saw the demonstration
right.
And all that. But outside, generally in the population, people told me there was no reaction. People were tired of this whole process, in and out, and who they want stability, they want jobs, they want to see some.
Well, on the world news broadcasts here, they had people crying in the street throughout the entire country, so they didn't give that impression at all.
That's right, and you know they are very visible, and they were out there. They had mobilized them, and if the election outcome had been different, you can be sure you would have seen the consequences of this. People said, you know, they're going to burn Cairo down, and the military was deployed, ready for it. But we already saw a court ruling that minimized, or limited, I should say, the power of the military in terms of arresting civilians, and which is part of their effort for law and order. So we also are concerned now what the ramifications of this will be for the relationship with Israel. There was a report that he made an interview, Morsi, with a Fars news agency, and in which he said that he would end the relationship with Israel, build the ties to Iran, and it turns out that it never took place. He may have made comments to the mullahs in Iran, and they leaked it, but it's very interesting on two grounds. One, about the nature of this effort to try and portray Egypt and Iran coming together, something that Khamenei spoke about just about 2 weeks ago, talking about how we have these, if you have Egypt and Iran working together, they obviously lock in Israel, they can dominate the region, it'll change the whole dynamic, two Islamist regimes, empowering other similar regimes. But it also reflects the fight between Ahmadinejad and Khamenei, because IRNA, which is the Iran news agency, was the first to release the story that the Fars interview. Fars is associated with Ahmadinejad, IRNA with Khamenei. So it was part of their internal fight also about the legitimacy of the story.
Well, you forget sometimes how much infighting there is in their Iranian leadership, you know?
That's right, and it doesn't get much coverage, and I keep saying people should look at it. I think Ahmadinejad clearly is the loser.
Right.
And this comes in advance of the ban on July 1st that's coming into effect on all the European oil being cut off. South Korea, interestingly, announced on its own that it's going to halt all its Iran oil imports on July 1st. The U.S. is working on tougher sanctions. Obviously, after the Moscow meetings failed, though people tried again, and Ashton and others, to put a positive spin. Britain, interestingly enough, is taking the lead in talking about even tougher sanctions to come, and the need to put more pressure on. I hope that the administration and Congress will, as they've spoken about, will do more. And it's important, especially now, the sanctions will have much greater impact because the price of oil is down 25%. For Iran, this is a huge blow because they budget at least $95 a barrel oil.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's below, it's way below 95.
Yeah, you had always said 100 was the magic number. Right?
And 100, exactly. And now with oil down, it is hurting Iran. It also hurts Russia, by the way. And the Congress is working on new efforts. The world oil supply right now is up, and you see the drop in gas prices, etc., because of the slowdown of economies like China and in Europe. So so the demand for oil is down, but the spare capacity for production is pretty tight.
I don't know if there's a simple answer to this question, but at the beginning of this section of our conversation, the first comparison of where the direction Morsi is likely going was Erdogan and Turkey. Why not Ahmadinejad and Iran? Why wouldn't that be your first reaction in terms of where he could potentially be heading?
Well, first of all, that was an Islamist revolution to start. Here, I think that the model that they know how to win the support of the West, if they were to come all out, give their full agenda, you know that the United States and its $2-plus billion is not going to be forthcoming.
Right.
That it will get Saudi Arabia more worked up, and they depend on aid from Saudi Arabia, or are seeking aid from Saudi Arabia, which does not like the Muslim Brotherhood. So they know that the model is not to do it as an open confrontation, just like in the demonstrations during the revolution against Mubarak. You hardly saw a Muslim Brotherhood presence, because they knew that if it looks like it's a Muslim Brotherhood undertaking, it would alienate a lot of the people in the West. So I think that the model of Turkey, and the fact that Turkey gets such strong support from the United States, NATO, Europe, etc., even to the point of excluding Israel from many security conferences and other events, is the model. You saw this week Rahimi, the vice president of Iran, made a vicious anti-Semitic speech at an international gathering that dealt with drugs. He, of course, blamed the Gemara, the Talmud, for it, and said all sorts of things about how the Jews were in the Russian Revolution and none of them died, and all sorts of horrific things, with a dozen or more European Western representatives sitting there. Not one of them got up and walked out. Some issued statements afterwards. Ban Ki-moon has issued a statement, you know, criticizing it. But the fact is that nobody got up and walked out after this kind of a vicious anti-Semitic diatribe. And what I think is important, that it follows what I mentioned on the air, Khamenei's website depicting a map of Israel and him showing which missiles will hit each part of Israel. You put those two things together. For those who do not think and don't get why I stress the urgency of Iran. Iran is a powerful country. And in the wake of the Muslim Brotherhood victories, they will be able to exploit more and more situations. We've done nothing for the forces that want to upset this government from inside, and we know that there are more efforts. We see that Iran's arsenal of smart weapons, anti-ship and missiles and cruise missiles, submarines, mines, all these things that they could use to block shipping of oil from the Straits of Hormuz and their ability to threaten, let alone the fact that they're moving ahead all the time on the nuclear program. Nobody talks about what progress they're making, but it's going ahead. And when you think of people who tell you what their attitude toward Jews or Israel, to the West, to the United States, is, and what their intentions are,
right,
then you got to really get people.
And after yesterday, the Supreme Court decision, it's obvious that this campaign in the United States is going to be even more about domestic issues and foreign policy issues.
Yeah, that is true. It's overwhelming about domestic issues, and my concern is not just what the general American public, but when people in the community don't get it and don't understand the priorities, that it has to be a balance of domestic and international.
Right.
That you know, when they have the opportunity to speak to leaders and talk about, you know, as important as certain domestic issues are, and not to stress what is really a potentially life and death issue for us.
Here's an issue that never seems to go away. This week, the Financial Times of Germany said a regional court in Cologne, in western Germany, ruled that religious circumcision on a minor is illegal. I mean, I know that this issue constantly comes up in different legal situations, Malcolm. Some of them seem to be important decisions, meaning that it could lead to a larger ban, and others seem to be not such a big deal, more of an isolated type. What is this one?
Well, there is a pattern of these things going across Europe, and they target the two things that historically have been symptomatic of the rise of anti-Semitic feelings, and the easy thing to mobilize against. One is shechita, ritual slaughter, and the other is Brit Milah, circumcision. And, you know, they try to always justify it on scientific grounds or other grounds, you know, that this is torturous, when for a few thousand years it's not been a problem. I think it is a matter of concern, people have already turned to the parliament in Germany and others to rescind this or overturn it or to counter it. But I think that they're symptomatic, and it is troubling.
In this case, it would just apply to that region of Germany?
That's only for there. But when the court rules,
right,
you can use that as a precedent in other places.
Is it interesting to find Jews and Muslims fighting on the same side of an issue?
Well, it's always interesting, but it's not the only case, because the ritual slaughter also affects halal. And in some countries, they try to make a distinction because they can stun the animals, and
right,
they're not bound by the same halachic restrictions, I think. But in the principle, it has brought Muslims and Jews together.
All right, Malcolm, here we go. This is how we wrap up this week. You were just in Israel. I'm sure you had more than one conversation with the Prime Minister and multiple conversations with people who have influential roles when it comes to the future of the Tal law, and people are watching this very carefully and are very curious where this is going. Is there going to be a major change? Do you think, based on the conversations that you had, that in fact Israeli society is going to have to prepare for something very different when it comes to the rules of army service?
No, there will be changes. It's inevitable. It's what the overwhelming majority of the people want, and I had the opportunity not just to meet with many government people about it, but also with some key leaders of both the Haredi and from communities in Israel who are concerned and who recognize the fact that there needs to be some change. You know, the demands of economic conditions for people to go to work and enabling them, but finding ways that are acceptable, that don't endanger their or accommodate their beliefs, but at the same time, everybody wants to avoid, I think, a rift. Well, I shouldn't say everybody. Most people want to avoid a rift. There are extremists always who look to exploit any situation on both sides, on all sides.
Right.
I think that there is a real sensitivity to it and an understanding that that they need to find some basis. I think General Mofaz will be involved in it. I know that he and Netanyahu met about this within recent hours to talk about some ways of approaching it. I urge them to reach out to the community, to the Haredi community's leaders there, and talk to them and see whether what kind of understandings or accommodations could be made that would meet everybody's need. National service is an option for a lot of people. There are distinctions between those who are really learning and some who are not, and who really could benefit, and the Army would have to accommodate their needs. So the Army can't even take all of them, but it's the principle. I think if more of them become contributing members of society, they work, and I understand that many, many do want to work, and as one of the great leaders said to me, the problem is they go to work, they get the bottom-line jobs, and they never advance. He said if you want to motivate them, you have to show them that there's a chance for them to move up and to advance and to be able to earn a decent living.
The same leaders you met with likely, well, you would know, do they say different things publicly on this issue than they would have said to you or did say to you in private?
No, they didn't say anything different. It may not have been in all the detail, but I think in their exchanges with officials, they say exactly what they said to me. And it's a general understanding and a general sensitivity, and what we have to avoid is a rift. And given all the dangers Israel faces, and we didn't talk about what's going on in the Sinai and the implications of Morsi's victory for that, or in Gaza, and the missiles that are still flying from Gaza into Israel, you know, there has to be some way of reaching an understanding and avoid an open split, open confrontation, even if it may involve some, but to isolate it at least. And I think it can benefit everybody. So I hope and I think that certainly Netanyahu is sensitive to it, other people, Mofaz is somebody who is sensitive to it, and certainly I think there are leaders in the Haredi community who are very sensitive, and some of them have made statements about the need for people to go to work because they see the impact, the poverty, some of the strains that this causes within in the families and in communities.
And I saw an article, I think it was the Jerusalem Post, about the rift that could be created between the Likud and the Haredim. Would you consider that relationship a good one at this point? I never looked
yes,
at them.
I do think that generally there is a pretty good relationship. You know, the government still does immense things, and as one of the great names in that community said to somebody in my presence, that, you know, with 100,000 or 150,000 people learning full-time, that it's a Medina Shel Chesed, much to the shock of the person. And recognizing that this is a state that has been very generous and does good things, and Likud has generally been closer to the religious parties, although in the early years, the Mafal and others were always part of the labor coalition governments. So it has the potential of alienating people. And I don't think it should be just seen in the political context, because, you know, in terms of popularity, when you see it overwhelmingly, Israelis want everybody to serve, everybody to work, everybody to contribute. So it's probably popular politically, but this cannot be guided by just by political considerations. This, you have to think of this long-term for the unity of the Jewish state and the Jewish people.
Right. All right, am I here next week? I am. Are you around next week?
God willing.
All right, so next week we'll pick this up. Malcolm, thank you, Malcolm.
If you're sober by Friday, then we can do the show.
It's what?
If you're sober by Friday, we can do the show after your July 4th celebration.
Don't release all my secrets on the air, please. That's for a private conversation. Malcolm, have a great job. As Malcolm Holmline is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update on Fridays here at JM.